Arnold Prieto is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Prieto to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. The Execution Watch for Arnold Prieto begins.
Good evening. This is Ray Hill. I'm host.
It'll take about.
Hello. Hello. Pat, are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Where,
yes, I am.
Where is there?
We're up at the walls in Huntsville. The witnesses have just walked across, so we know there are no pending appeals.
Okay, let me explain something to our listening audience, because it grows all the time, and I forget to do backlog, and I will play off you to do that. Because you've been following executions for how long, Pat?
Quite a few years.
And that takes you regularly to Huntsville, where the action is, right?
Yes, every time there's an execution, there's a pretty large group up here.
And it varies because of weather and other circumstances and from case to case.
Yes, it does. And it varies also if family members are able to come.
What have we got today?
We've got about 25 people. We've got four family members, and I did ask them if they wanted to be on the radio, but circumstances are such that they can't be right now.
What does it mean when the witnesses cross the road?
That means that there are no more appeals and the execution will go forward. When they go in, it'll be about 25 minutes before they come out again. And when they come out, we know that the execution is over.
We understand that Arnold Prieto is basically what you call a volunteer at this point. Is that true?
A volunteer of what?
In other words, he'd ask that his appeals not be forwarded.
Not that I'm aware.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know.
We will revisit that when the attorneys get on. But this is normal procedure. There was nothing pending this afternoon. And if there's nothing pending, the witnesses cross the road and the procedure begins, and then we count the minutes until he
Yes, what I am aware of, that there were no appeals because he had a state-appointed attorney that did not file any.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Pat, and we never do Execution Watch where we don't learn something.
That's right.
That's the way, and that's why we do it.
Well, we do learn this is Abbott's first execution, and he just took office yesterday.
Okay. Yes, he did. He swore in yesterday. First Catholic we've had in a long time, and apparently he doesn't pay much attention to the Pope.
I guess not.
All right. Thank you very much, Pat. You know when you need to get back in touch with us.
Yes, I will. When the witnesses come out, I'll call you right back.
Thank you, Sister. I appreciate it. I hope it's not too uncomfortable in the weather up there. Okay, and that was Pat Hartwell. And Pat is our reporter in Huntsville today. You heard other noises in the background. There's usually some megaphones. She said there was a goodly number of folks that showed up today. There are some regulars, and then there are people from Europe who are visiting Texas in a wonder, a quandary about executions. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, it's kind of a bizarre murder case, more so than what we've had before. Arnold Prieto is a 20-year-old kid living up in Carrollton, which is a suburb of Dallas. And while he was up there, he met a couple of brothers named Jesse and Guadalupe Hernandez. And they gave him free cocaine to begin with. And then they started doing a lot of cocaine together. And apparently their whole activity up there involved using cocaine and watching movies at night. Well, obviously, Prieto runs out of money pretty quickly. And Guadalupe Hernandez kept talking about this uncle that he had in San Antonio. He claimed his uncle was a loan shark. when in fact his uncle operated a check cashing business. And Guadalupe claimed his uncle had stacks of cash back in the closet of his home, and that he was talking about going up there and robbing his uncle to get more money for cocaine. He was an uncle by marriage because his aunt was his was Jesse's was a, Guadalupe's aunt was maternal aunt. Anyway, what happened? Guadalupe had a brother named Jesse. So what? On the day this occurred, Jesse Hernandez, Guadalupe Hernandez start off to San Antonio from Carrollton. They drive up in Prieto's car. They get there in the middle of pretty early in the morning. And on the way up there, they kept doing cocaine all the way up there. And Prieto claims that during the trip up there, Guadalupe explained, when we do the murders, we need to take our shoes off, put socks on our hands, so we won't find fingerprints. And they even gave a demonstration in the car about touching the window, showing there'd be no prints if you had his socks on his hands.
So there was obviously mutual involvement in all the parties.
Absolutely. Really, it's more and more than that. Guadalupe is the one that kind of put it together. It's his family. He was the one that kind of suggested wanting to rob him. Really, he was, if you call him a mastermind, you'd call him the one. Well, they arrive at his aunt's house. She's a 61-year-old woman. Her husband is 72 years old. And living in the house is a nanny that took care of their children. It was 92 years old. There were three real elderly people in the house. And so when they get there, the folks would admit them in fact, feed them breakfast. And after they get through eating breakfast, Arn Prieto goes back in the bedroom where the old 72-year-old man gentleman is, hears a noise and looks out, and Guadalupe Hernandez is stabbing his aunt to death with a screwdriver, a long-handled screwdriver.
Guadalupe is doing
right, Guadalupe.
Because we're going to sort all this. Can you hold on just a second?
Sure.
Let me get Dave in here. Dave, are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
Where is here?
Well, we're in front of St. Stephen's Church on the corner of Alabama and Woodhead.
All right, that's an Episcopal church over on Alabama. How many vigilants have you?
We've got about seven people here, I think.
Okay, that's a good
six or seven. And yeah, not a big group.
And passing traffic can see you. You got signs and banners?
We got signs, banners saying stop executions. Heavy traffic. There's always a lot of traffic through here because rush hour. And so we've got, we're making our stand. We're showing people what we believe in, which is abolition of the death penalty.
Pat Hartwell is in Huntsville, and she said the witness is across the road. So
okay.
It's just a matter of countdown until something terrible happens. Can you tell people how they can get in touch with your organization?
The best way to get in touch with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty is to go on the web and go to tcadp.org, tcadp.org, and they get information about all the events and everything that's coming up, including the annual conference we have up in Austin, which is really a good event.
When is that conference?
That's in February. I don't know if I don't have the exact date in front of me, but it's later on in February.
Well, we're going to be talking right now, scheduled twice next week. I hope that doesn't happen. But if we are, have that information with you to share it with the audience.
Okay.
And I think I saw a TD. I saw your banner in the March of Martin Luther King Parade.
Right, right. We had a group of people that marched down there. They joined in with the end mass incarceration Houston folks and the Amnesty International folks, and they all marched together. My wife has been sick, so I wasn't there, but I heard it was a good, great turnout and a great parade.
Thank you, Dave, and I probably won't be talking to you the rest of this evening, but the procedure has begun, and the only thing we worry about is it taking longer than usual.
Okay, all right.
Bye-bye. And that was Dave Atwood with Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. All right. Now, we've gotten Guadalupe.
Okay. I failed to mention the old gentleman's name is Rodolfo Hernandez, and his wife is named Virginia Hernandez. And the 92-year-old kind of had been a nanny was by the name of Paula Morgan. And they were the victims in this case. And I said earlier, Guadalupe started stabbing his Aunt Virginia with a screwdriver. And when that happened, Arnold Prieto was back in the bedroom with Mr. Hernandez, the old gentleman Rodolfo. He gets up to try to help him. Jesse Hernandez pushed him back on the bed, and at that point, another screwdriver apparently appears. And at this point, we have our guy Prieto stabbing Mr. Hernandez numerous times with a screwdriver, several times in the back of the head. As a matter of fact, I think when it's all totaled, Virginia Hernandez had been stabbed 30-something times, and Mr. Hernandez, her husband, been stabbed like 20-something
times. It was not a pretty
really
scene.
Bad. So at this point, they kill both of them, and then they hear a noise. And apparently, the elderly lady, 92-year-old woman, had been a nanny to the Hernandez children. She heard the noise and comes out. And he hears a noise, and somebody had hit her and knocked her down. He thought she was unconscious. And then they start at that point. They pry open the closet where the money's supposed to be hidden. They see Guadalupe get a bunch of envelopes, stuff them in a bag, and they start grabbing jewelry and everything they can find. And at this point, apparently someone realized that the 90-year-old woman was not dead. So Jesse, with a screwdriver, stabs her to death. So we have Guadalupe killing his aunt. We have Prieto killing his uncle. And we have Jesse, the brother, killing the elderly lady.
How do we know all of this?
Well, I'm going to tell you if you just slow down. Okay. They go back to Carrollton, and at that time, they don't know what to do. When I read the trial transcripts, what it basically says, the police in Carrollton picked up the two Hernandez brothers, and apparently they talked about the murder and implicated Prieto. They go pick up Prieto, and he makes a full confession. After about 4 hours, he confesses to everything. And we know all about this primarily because of the confession. And all three of them are charged with capital murder in San Antonio. And what they normally do is, we've talked about before, if you've got three guys charged with capital murder, you always try the strong case first because they got a confession and they think those will fall like dominoes. So he goes to trial first and gets the death penalty.
So Prieto was the one that was tried first.
Yes, sir.
And but they were all three charged
with capital murder.
Now, one of them was actually a juvenile.
Well, what happened? I never could find the age of Guadalupe. I'm assuming he's the older brother of Jesse. Jesse was 16 at the time of the murder.
Okay.
He's certified over, pleads for a life sentence. And Guadalupe, I'm assuming, had to be an adult at that point. And for some strange reason, all the lawyers have speculated, his case was dismissed for insufficient evidence, when in fact he was the mastermind of all of it. It was his idea to do the robbery. It was his uncle and aunt that he led them to, and he's the one that started the killing. He was the first one that killed anybody. But yet his case is dismissed, and I'm assuming unless someone's knocked him in the head, that he's still walking around San Antonio somewhere.
And this is an example of how bizarre cases
really
can
insane.
Twist.
Yeah. Crazy.
Okay. Did Guadalupe actually have a trial?
It just simply said, and all the stuff I could find, his case was dismissed. Insufficient evidence, which means he never went to trial.
He never went to trial.
No.
Nobody went under oath. No jury was picked. It was a prosecutorial decision to dismiss based on whatever logic or reason Bexar County had to
own
that.
As Larry so often says, judicial, what is it you say all the
discretion.
Time? Discretion. And this would be judicial indiscretion, I would think. Prosecutorial indiscretion.
They didn't try the kid either.
No, he was certified
he
over.
He
got a life plan. He's certified over. Because what they do, if once you get the death penalty on one person, okay, everybody else gets scary. And
now, when you're
pleading.
16, ever how you get to adult court, when you're 16, life is not the big Megilla.
Right. It's not the life without parole. It's life.
It's not life. It's just life.
Back then, it was straight life.
Right. And so the only sacrifice to the crime gods is made in this case is being made right now.
Right. And really, he was more or less, the best you could characterize him as kind of a tag-along.
And dumb.
The reason I think his confession has a lot of credibility, normally he's trying to blame it on everybody else. He would never admit killing anybody himself. And he readily admits that he killed the old gentleman.
Well, he admits getting sick because of
right.
that.
Right. He said he threw up on the way back from Dallas.
I mean, just thinking about it was nauseating to him, made him sick and threw up.
Well, he claimed at the very beginning, once they got to the house and Virginia Hernandez fed him breakfast, gave him orange juice, everybody was friendly, he thought they were all going to not do it. He was shocked until he went back in the bedroom with Mr. Hernandez, then you heard Guadalupe stabbing his aunt.
What happens when you have a confession like that and you have a capital case? What is the procedure here?
You mean the procedure like what?
I mean, go ahead. You have a trial.
You have a trial. Normally,
you have a trial on guilt or innocence.
Have a trial on guilt or innocence.
Which the confession is a major piece of evidence.
Well, it is the major piece of evidence. Yeah. It is the evidence, and it's really kind of a foregone conclusion you're going to be convicted, because there never was a claim in any of the writs that the confession was coerced or forced, so you have an admissible confession. And he lays out everything pretty well, like I just got through
saying. In great detail.
In great detail.
Before, after, and during.
Absolutely. He laid it all out. And what makes it is, have a ring of credibility is he admits doing one of the killings himself. Normally, if they're blaming everybody else, he would say, well, I was just there. I didn't think they were going to do it, blah, blah, blah. But in this case, he admits one of the murders.
Do they have to try punishment with a confession like that?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
How do they do that?
All they do is find you guilty, and this thing go from there. If they find you guilty, into a second phase of the trial called the punishment hearing. Because remember, in Texas, there are really two trials. There's a trial on guilt or innocence. That's where the confession comes into play. If they find you guilty, they have a second trial on punishment, so it's really a two-phase process. And Susan's going to talk about all the punishment evidence.
Okay, then let's line her up.
Okay.
My name is Ray Hill. I'm the host of Execution Watch. Texas is killing Arnold Prieto tonight. That is in progress. And as that is happening, we're trying to tell you as much as we know about this case. Hi, Susan.
Hello, Ray. Okay, well, Mr. Prieto, at the time of the crime, Mr. Prieto, he's only 20 years old, so he doesn't, obviously...
These are kids.
Right. So he obviously doesn't have a long time to, shall we say, you know, have
one
a of lot of past behavior.
One of them 16. The other one is older, but we don't know how much. Right. And then a 20-year-old. So these are all kids.
Okay. So he's 20 years old. The state does put on evidence at the punishment phase that he had been involved in organized crime, and essentially the organized crime was that he and I guess other individuals were stealing merchandise
and drugs.
Well, and reselling it, okay? Apparently he was involved in stealing, they say, about $600,000 or more of computer equipment from his employer. But he was involved in what you could say is a theft racket, that they were stealing, you know, computers, whatever, you know, different types of, like, car equipment and so forth, and that it was obviously, you know, reselling it. They had some fence to resell it or something. Okay, so they brought, you know, that, the state put that on it, punishment. Also, he admitted to some burglaries in 1990. So that came out also in punishment. And when he was incarcerated in jail for the year before the trial, he had numerous rule violations, infractions of all kinds, like failure to obey orders, you know, just a whole number of them. So, you know, that clearly, that also came out, okay? What he took issue with, what he took issue with on the punishment portion of his trial was he wanted three pieces of evidence brought into the trial that his attorneys did not, you know, bring into the trial in front of the jury. And one was that he said his attorneys did not produce his school records to show what a poor student he was, and basically to support sort of his contention that his career opportunities were limited because he had to drop out of school and partially support his family.
Well, you're a criminal defense lawyer. Would you consider that pertinent evidence for a capital case?
I mean, I think in his case, let's just say maybe it would help. It certainly
wouldn't hurt.
Yeah. I certainly don't see any harm in it. But basically, the jury did know that he was a high school dropout. Obviously, the school records would have been some documentary evidence that what a poor student he was. Another piece of evidence that he wanted to have come on that didn't, the jury clearly knew that he was a drug user and a cocaine user. There was no expert testimony from a doctor as to the effect that cocaine use would have on judgment and his ability, you know, his brain function and his ability to make, shall we say, sound judgments. So he felt that there should have been some expert testimony from a doctor.
His ideas to his attorneys, and they're not following through.
I don't know if that was his ideas to his attorneys before the punishment trial, or if this came up afterwards.
Okay.
Also, he
But as a criminal defense lawyer, that drug addiction and the effects of drug addiction would have had little bearing on a capital case.
It's hard to say, because in this particular case, apparently one juror did send out a note asking the court if drug use was a mitigating factor.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, they clearly knew he was a drug user from, you know, all the facts of the trial. If it would have made a difference on a doc, on an expert testimony on that, I mean, it's really hard to say. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. Okay, that would just be one
factor.
So
somebody in the jury room was anguishing over having to make this decision.
Well, there was a note that came out that said, basically asked the court if drug use was a mitigating factor.
Did the court answer that question?
I mean, yeah, the court answered the question, but, I mean, they had, in other words, the juror, they had the facts, okay?
Yeah.
The next thing that's, I guess you could say this kind of, it's a little bit strange, but he gave a statement to the police. Now, in his statement to the police, and there were some areas that you could say he softened his participation in the crime, you know, by him saying in his statement that he thought they weren't going to carry out the plan, part of his statement where he says that he was sickened after the crime, mm-hmm. that he was nauseous, that he was shaken, and so forth. So, but he also admits in the statement, you know, a participation in killing Rodolfo, that he killed him with a screwdriver. So he felt at punishment that his lawyers should have put his statement or confession on as evidence for the jury. Now, that could have, I'm not really sure that would have helped or not.
From that question, apparently they put some of that confession on in front of the jury. They just didn't put all of it?
I mean, they would have his confession, you know, from the guilt or innocence of the trial.
That's property of the state, and they can use it as they want.
Sure. I mean, you know, and that could have, I'm not really sure if that would have helped or not, because in one sense, part of his statement, he's sort of softening up his, you know, role in it, although he clearly admits to committing a murder. But in any event, those claims did not, shall we say, that did not result in any relief on the punishment.
Were there any other notes that you know of, or just that one?
No, that's the only one I know of.
Okay. Do you have any idea of the time estimate in deliberation?
Apparently, there was some deliberation because there was some deliberation. I don't know the exact time.
Yeah.
Jim, do you know? There's no indication in the record of the time frame.
Yeah, right. They usually don't put that in the court record, but it would be in the media coverage of the thing, and that's frequently important. Did they go in there in 20 minutes, come out, didn't even have time to elect a foreperson, and then they get out and do the deed?
I mean, apparently the jurors really, you know, did deliberate.
And
I mean,
this is Bexar County. This is San Antonio, Texas.
Right, but they had long, I mean, apparently they did deliberate. Apparently, in his motion for new trial, what he claimed in the motion for a new trial was that one of the jurors had changed their vote from life to death or uncertain to death, and that change of that juror's vote was, shall we say, precipitated by another juror talking about parole, that if he got good conduct on a life sentence, he may be released, you know, earlier on parole.
And that's,
okay.
That's specifically inappropriate discussion.
Right. The foreman of the grand jury told the jurors that they could not consider or discuss it. He did raise that at a motion for a new trial, but the foreman of the grand jury also testified that he put a stop to it and said they could not.
Nipped it in the bud.
Right.
Okay. This is a more convoluted case than I would imagine. It looks like Mike Gillespie's arming up here. Hello, Mike.
Good evening, Ray.
What's your piece of this puzzle?
Well, after the conviction and after he was sentenced to death, he blamed his lawyers. And he filed papers saying the lawyers were not competent for what they did and he wanted reversed. The issues he brought up in appeal are the same reasons, the same issues Susan just talked about.
Yeah.
They didn't use the school records. They didn't bring in the doctor's report. They didn't bring in his confession. Susan talked about that in detail.
Sure.
I'm not going to talk about that. But what the appellate court said is that the attorney produced enough records to give the jury the right to find life in prison, but they didn't. And because they didn't, they were not going to reverse it. They said the lawyers could have done better, but they did enough. And as Susan said, each one of the points he made, there's reasons for the lawyers not to do it. Not to bring in the evidence of drugs, and not to bring in the school records. These are reasons not to do it. So to blame the lawyer, they said, is not enough to reverse the case.
Well, what is the criteria here? I mean, the appeal is supposed to look at the trial process and trial lawyer and decisions of the judge during the process. That's normally what an appeal is about. Well, the judge didn't get to make any decisions because the lawyers did not present this evidence.
The judge would not have made that decision.
No.
The jury would have made the decision, but the fear is the evidence would have hurt him more than helped him.
In the mind of his criminal defense lawyers, there was as much bad stuff there as there was potentially good stuff. And is that your impression?
That's my impression, but to me, it misses the real point. When they had that confession, how are you going to win the case? All this talk about being a bad student, the confession was horrible.
Yeah.
The strategy that some lawyers use, as we've talked before, is when you have bad facts, plead guilty to the facts, and go to the jury for punishment. The lawyer did have the right to stand up when he was arraigned and have him say, I did it, I'm sorry.
Sure.
I gave a confession.
Yep.
Read the jury the confession. Have the boy take the stand. Then talk about his school records. Then talk about
He had nothing to lose from taking the stand because his under punishment, all of his criminal record was out there.
That's right.
Not inadmissible evidence.
That's right.
You need that stuff for future dangerousness.
And so at least you can present somebody that looks sympathetic to the jury, and he can take the stand and talk to the jury. Not that it might have done any good, but they could have given him life instead of the death penalty. But the lawyer did not do that. That's the first thing to talk about, whether or not the lawyer should have done it. The second thing to consider, on the lawyer's viewpoint, we've all been talking about this. Why did the one Hernandez brother walk away? This man...
The mystery of this case is not who they're executing. The mystery of this case is why the guy walked.
In his they said he walked because there was not enough evidence. This man, who they executed tonight, saw the man kill his aunt. Seems to me that that's evidence. There's rules about co-conspirators with independent evidence, but we think that could have been met. The puzzling thing, from my viewpoint, is why his lawyer did not try to use his testimony to get a plea bargain. Why would they release the worst person, execute the least culpable person?
Well, there's the other question, and Otis has brought to my attention. If you've got all this confession, all that, why have a trial at all?
Well, because you have to have a trial.
To kill somebody, you have to have a trial.
Well, let's talk about...
The requirements of capital punishment is that you have to go through the motions, even though that is a fruitless exercise on behalf of the defendant.
Well, we're talking about guilt or innocence now, not punishment.
Okay.
The only issue in guilt or innocence is, did he do it?
Yeah.
a theory that a lot of people believe is that the jury is less sympathetic of somebody that lies and then comes back and asks for mercy. When you gave a confession, you were up front with the police. You confessed everything. It seems to me the jury should see the same what the police saw. He was caught. He confessed everything. He said who did it. That might have given him some mitigating to the jury to give him life. I'm not saying they would have, but you're not going to win the guilt and innocence stage.
No, the guilt and innocence is already established. So, confession took care of that. And there's no indication, and you've got nothing to lose by putting him on the stand because all of his past criminal history is going to come out anyway.
And it wasn't that bad.
But there's no indication that they put him on the stand.
No.
Never put him on the stand. Get close to the microphone.
Here's what you have to kind of wonder. When they brought out his record when he was in jail waiting trial,
yeah,
and the numerous violations, like the violations they had were violation of security rules, violation that he would not violated taking direct orders, contraband violation, mm-hmm. yelling, just basically not following the rules in what he was asked to in jail, changing channels on the TV, I guess disrupted people. It makes you wonder, maybe there was something in his demeanor that maybe the lawyers might have thought, you know, this
Susan,
he might not come across as well. That
could happen. That jury is never going to understand day-to-day life in the culture of being in prison mm-hmm. or jail. I've lived there, so I understand all of that. If it's presented as evidence, they don't have any context to put it in. Unless he's there.
What I'm trying to say is the lawyers would pick up, look at a person's demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are going to have, shall we say, a more pleasant demeanor.
Some people are more charismatic than others.
Right. And they have like a more pleasant demeanor, or they don't appear to be, hostile. Some people project a more hostile demeanor, regardless of whatever their, the crime is or isn't. People do pick up a demeanor, and maybe that was a factor, that the lawyers, I don't know.
Might there be a language problem here? I mean, we have somebody that's not too bright who probably spoke Spanish in home, however, in his discussion, how do we know what he wanted brought to the table? We have that from later appeals.
Well, what he raised post conviction.
Yeah, but he didn't write that. A lawyer wrote that.
Well, yeah. I mean, clearly a lawyer wrote it. That's what they came up with post-conviction.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm just saying possibly his demeanor, a client's demeanor may affect the lawyer's decision.
Factor in that decision. Yeah. We can go back there and eyeball this situation when it happened. We need to get Pat on the phone. She's going to call in?
She'll
call in. Pat has just notified our producer that she's going to call in momentarily, and that's going to happen. And as soon as it does, we'll put her on the air, because that is probably the most important thing of doing the show. Although, let me tell you, you folks, Susan and Roger, Pat, what's going on?
The media is leaving, so we know the execution has taken place.
So, as of right now, Arnold Prieto is dead, killed by the state with a lethal injection in Huntsville, Texas. How long were the witnesses in?
They've been in there for about 30 minutes, I guess.
Okay, if they go in and get set it down, the execution itself probably took a little over 20 minutes to complete.
I would think so.
Thank you, Pat.
519 for the state, number one for Greg Abbott.
Go around and tell the other vigilants that we appreciate their stalwartness.
And the family wanted me to tell the radio, even though they're unable to talk, they wanted to extend their appreciation to everyone that has supported Arnold and that was out here.
Well, this has been quite an experience as we've gone through the trial and the hearing. The attorneys have done a very good job of researching it, and we're all in a quandary. not so much that they killed Prieto, because they were going to kill somebody in this case anyway.
Yeah.
But why did the person who organized the effort in the first place was also one of the killers? Why did he walk without even a trial?
One walked because he was a day under 17, and the other one walked.
Well, no, he got a life. That one got a life.
Oh, and the other one, my understanding, he walked because Arnold refused to testify against his friends.
Okay. Okay, well, I appreciate that information, because it's a mystery here of why they could say they didn't have enough evidence. And
when you don't turn state evidence,
the confession that Arnold gave, which now property of the state could be used against Guadalupe.
I don't know. I would have to read up on it before I gave you an opinion.
But I appreciate your role, and keep up the good work, and we'll see you back in town.
Okay, thank you very much. Unfortunately, I'll see you next week.
Yes, ma'am. Hopefully we get stays.
I hope so.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Pat Hartwell, and she's up there on her own nickel because she cares about the issue. Well, Larry Douglas is the next lawyer in the bar. What's your piece of this puzzle?
Well, I don't want to get too involved in a fine legal oddity that this case raises, but Susan mentioned earlier that Prieto's lawyers filed a motion for new trial. There are certain grounds that can be used to file a motion for new trial under the rules of appellate procedure, some of which is that there was jury misconduct.
Okay.
And the jury misconduct, as Susan mentioned earlier, was that one of the jurors indicated that she had changed her vote on punishment from either uncertain to death or from life to death, as a apparent result of another juror, or maybe two jurors, mentioning that there was a possibility that Prieto, for good time, for good conduct, might be able to get his sentence reduced from the statutory minimum, which is 45 years. So that would have come out from the lawyers, the appellate lawyers, interviewing the jurors. The other jurors who might have made the statement did not submit themselves to an interview, but the jury foreman did. Jury foreman indicated that, you know, once those discussions were first brought up, that he then went back and reread the jury instructions, which said that the minimum that Prieto would serve under a life sentence was 40 years. And further, that they shouldn't even be discussing parole as part of their deliberation on punishment. Now, even if they had continued, that's something the jury can't do. But even if they had, the fact that they're doing it, there's an evidentiary rule that says that a juror cannot impeach his own verdict. So even though the lawyers then developed these affidavits, but the affidavits are deemed to be incompetent. They couldn't be used to impeach the verdict of the jury, because the jury's verdict is the jury's verdict. Now, if you're going to impeach the jury's verdict, you've got to do something from the outside, or something that was introduced to the jury from an outside source, but not the juror's own internal deliberation or their thought process. That could not be used. And so no matter their having developed this, but the evidentiary rule says that no matter that the juror could not testify, a juror's testimony could not be used to impeach his own verdict, nor could an affidavit based on that testimony be used to impeach the jury's verdict, unless the affidavit or the testimony is directed at something that came from the outside, or something that showed that the juror was ineligible to serve. But as to their deliberation, and the feeling, the rationale for that is to prevent defense lawyers from
constantly harassing jurors to get some kind of jury misconduct from a jury's own thought process. You know, how did you arrive at your verdict? Well, the evidentiary rule is clear that no matter how the jurors came up with the verdict, even if that involved a violation of their own oath to serve as jurors, so long as it didn't come from an outside source or did not affect the jurors' eligibility to serve as a juror, then that testimony, no matter how persuasive it might be, was simply not competent testimony to serve as a basis for a motion for new trial.
Wow. So unless the judge makes a serious error at allowing some evidence that shouldn't be there or disallowing some evidence that should be there, once the jury has made their decision, that holds. So if you're going to fault the trial, you've got to go upstream in the earlier part of the trial and find the error that is reversible.
And if you're filing a motion for new trial, there are lots of different grounds for doing it, including on the even on the appellate rule. If the juror were to decide the verdict by lot, or in a manner that's
putting down any numbers and dividing.
If they do that, they can't do it under the rules of appellate procedure. But if they do, or even if they negotiate the verdict, which they're not allowed to trade and so forth, even if they do all those things, so long as it's part of the internal deliberative process, without any external forces, and there's not something that prohibits them from disqualifies them from serving as jurors, then that testimony or affidavit based on that testimony is simply not competent testimony to support a motion for new trial.
Okay. We're learning a lot in this case, and I appreciate all the extra work you put on. We're gonna get Jack in here. Jack Lee, what's your piece of this puzzle?
I'm here to discuss why Guadalupe's
you're just going to dwell on that point. We've been on that point ever since you entered the building.
Well, that really is the only. I don't want to belittle what's happening here, the gravity of what's happening here, but that's really the only issue in this case. The only thing that leaves any question mark. You have a confession. You have a one of the co-defendants who was certified as an adult and then pled to a year of life in prison.
And that would be a 20-year life.
Right. And it's he was one day short of turning 17. At 17, there is no question he would have tried it. Yeah, it would have been all over but the shouting for him. Why on earth did Guadalupe's case get dismissed? It makes no sense. You have a confession where, frankly, it looks like Guadalupe is the ringleader. He's the mastermind of this.
Well, I've got a question about that. Pat up in Huntsville was under the impression that Arnold would not turn state's evidence against Guadalupe. It didn't make any difference.
It would be irrelevant. You have a confession.
They had the confession with the evidence in it, and that belonged to the state to do with as they please in Arnold's case or in any other case.
That's exactly right. And it makes no sense why this case was dismissed. I mean, I'm sure there's, I'm not sure. There might be information that we don't know about that might have caused the state to dismiss it all. But it leaves it all to speculation. It leaves all of it to speculation. And we just don't know.
Have you thought about the language problem?
Is it more
difficult to try a person who speaks and understands Spanish but not so much English in a court? Is it just a hassle?
It is
to have
more,
such a trial.
It's certainly more difficult. The court has to bring in translators, but it's San Antonio. You have a lot of people there who are bilingual, who speak Spanish,
You couldn't assemble a jury in San Antonio without Spanish-speaking people on it.
At least some people who speak some Spanish.
Yeah.
I think even that would be... The difficulty of running a trial ought to be irrelevant in the meeting.
Well, it ought to be. But hello, hello, Jack. I mean, you go to courthouses every day, and what ought to is frequently not
never
what
happens.
Is.
Yeah. Even if Guadalupe had some issues with speaking English, the courts would have hired translators for both. And as far as a juror is concerned, you have to be able to speak English in order to serve on the jury.
Sure, and the evidence would have gotten to you one way or the other. Yeah. Well, Jim's moving over to the thing. Jim, I'm still in a quandary, not just about. Guadalupe's walking. I'm in a quandary about several items in this case.
I need to straighten up some things. Number one, the evidence, let's talk about the evidence on Jesse. If they had enough evidence to convict Jesse, the brother, they had the same evidence against Guadalupe, because if this gentleman...
Yeah, but Jesse had a get-out-of-jail card. He was one day before he was 17th birthday.
But still, they convicted him, gave him a life sentence.
Sure.
If evidence is insufficient to put Guadalupe, why was it sufficient to put Jesse when they had the same evidence?
But they just scared that kid and didn't give him a trial.
Well, I don't know if that's true or not. But so far as insufficient evidence, they obviously had enough evidence to convict Jesse, or they'd have busted it on appeal. And so the evidence against Jesse is the same as evidence against Guadalupe.
It all goes back to that confession.
And so that's not going to wash that Arnold refused to testify against Guadalupe. They didn't testify in Jesse's case either, and they still convicted him. And so there's no difference in the evidence in Guadalupe and difference in the evidence in Jesse, yet Jesse gets lying.
Do we know for sure that Guadalupe is older than Jesse?
I have a hunch he is. I'm reading the opinion.
Sure.
But I'm saying the evidence is identical. So what difference does it make? And I need to clarify another couple of things that are somewhat confusing. Let me explain about confessions. When a confession is admitted by the state, they can bracket out certain portions of the confession.
They don't have to use it all.
Have to use it all. What you can do, if you think there's part of the confession that's self-serving, you put brackets around it. So when the prosecutor gets up and offers a confession, he offers only that part outside the brackets. And the reason being, they don't want to sponsor self-serving statements. Now, what the defense can do, once that's admitted, then they can offer into evidence of bracketed portions.
Okay.
So when a confession comes in, the state can kind of cherry-pick on what part of the confession they want to come in. And I think the argument was made, had the confession been admitted on appeal, they could have used the punishment hearing. It had already been admitted at the punishment hearing. And I think the argument made, if it was admitted at the punishment hearing, that it'd be more, they could use that unbracketed portion, the part that was sympathetic, to get more sympathy from the jury. Now, to Susan's point about demeanor, let me tell you what lawyers do. Years ago, I had a guy up in Conroe that was a Robitussin dealer that shot another Robitussin dealer.
Okay.
I went to see him in jail. His demeanor was horrible. Every other word was more vulgar than what I normally speak.
Oh,
he was dude this and dude that. And I said, only one person's allowed to cuss. That's me. And what I did, I hate to admit this, but I stole a Gideon Bible from a motel in Conroe. And I told this guy, I said, here's how it's going to work. You're going to read out loud a chapter of the Bible every day to learn to speak distinctly. Number two, if I hear you say another cuss word, I'm going to withdraw from your case. And I trained him. And I also had, we've gone so far as to get coaches to help people change their demeanor. When that guy got on the stand and testified, he had a handkerchief in his hand, and he sounded like Billy Graham. I almost fell through the floor. And the jury...
Did it work?
It worked, because the jury said, that's a self-educated man. Little did they know it was a stolen Bible from a motel that educated him.
Well,
you can change that demeanor, trust me.
Gideon ain't going to come back and check it out.
You know. He hadn't caught me yet. And the next thing I want to mention, let's talk about that lawyer ineffectiveness. The test, and it's really, really difficult. Here is the test. Number one, there is an extremely strong presumption that lawyers are effective. It is so strong, if you remember back years ago when George Walker used to appoint, what was the guy with the bad wig?
Oh, yeah.
You know I'm talking about, the lawyer with the bad wig that's dead. Now, Joe Cannon.
Joe Cannon.
He appointed Joe Cannon all the time.
Joe Cannon, you just don't wash your wig to wash your teria.
Cannon slept during part of the Capitol murder trial, and it was so bad the jury said the guy's sleeping. You know what they said on appeal? It was jury strategy. He was trying to get sympathetic from the jury just because he was sleeping. It's lawyer strategy. Fifth Circuit reversed it. There's a strong presumption that whatever the lawyer does at trial is right. And if the lawyer can show that anything he did was a trial tactic, even though the court doesn't agree with that tactic, they're going to affirm that case. It's extremely hard, and that's called a Strickland standard. Now, we've got a new case called Wiggins, and Wiggins is a little bit more powerful for the defense. Wiggins is that part of the deal where the lawyers don't do enough investigation into a case. And in this case, they said they investigated a little bit, could have done more, but wouldn't have made any difference, as Mike had said. So there was no Strickland error because, number one, everything he did was sound trial strategy, and there was no Wiggins error because there was no evidence left out that could have dug up.
Is it your gut that these lawyers did well enough?
Well, with that set of facts, it's the only thing I probably would have done differently. I would have, if Susan is correct about the demeanor, I would have spent a whole bunch of time in him in jail training him because, and I've said this 1,000 times and I've talked to people about cases, the most important part of a trial is when the jury first walks in, they look at your client and they start forming opinions.
Right then.
Immediately. Because I've had cases where a jury told me we've been voting since day one to vote not guilty, that was the day we picked the jury. You know why? Give you an example. Had a client that was a prostitute that was involved in killing some of her Johns. And so what I did, I had her on a pancake diet. She looked like Aunt Jemima when I got through with her.
Okay.
She had a bun, and nobody in the world would think she'd ever be a prostitute. So when the jury looks at her, they immediately start forming impressions. She can't be a hooker. Nobody would pay to go to bed with her.
She's flawed.
That's right. But you've got to realize that as a lawyer, you got to look at your client's demeanor. I've even called makeup people over. We had a guy.
No. I was asked to help pick a jury one time, and the defendant walked in there with a $250 due.
And, well, that's insane.
And so she had crispy pictures in that trial.
And you can change that.
Right. I said, you go mess up that hair. I don't care what it takes. You mess up and wear a flower-sack dress and try to drool on it during the course of this trial. She got probation.
That's what I'm talking
about. For crispy babies.
I defended a lawyer one time. The first time I saw him, he had a little mustache like Errol Flynn, monograph cuffs on his cufflinks, monograph shirts, and alligator shoes. That's the first thing you're going to do is shave the mustache off. Next thing, you're getting rid of them damn monogram shirts. You're going to buy just regular white shirts, and you're not going to wear alligator shoes. You're going to wear some penny loafers. And he bowed up like a toad and said, I've had this mustache for 20-some years.
It doesn't matter.
And I said, tell you what, in the morning, if you still got it, you got to get a new lawyer. And he shaved his mustache. But you can change that demeanor part. I want to put him on the stand.
Jim, we're a little over 5 minutes left in the show. Now, I want to pick your brain here just a second.
All right.
There's a whole bunch of people that have found out about Execution Watch in the last few months, and we haven't been in here doing too many executions.
Mm-hmm.
They're all tuned in, listen up. What do you think about how we're doing this show?
How we're doing it?
Yeah. What do you think about doing this show? As a piece of media, is this worth your time to do all of the enormous work that you do in every case?
Well, obviously, we have a whole group of lawyers, Larry, and we've got Mike, and we've got Jack, and we've got Susan, that work real hard putting these cases together. Obviously, they think it's worthwhile. They wouldn't do it because I work up the case. We sit down ahead of time. This is not something we do off the cuff. And if we didn't think it was worthwhile, we wouldn't be doing it. And the whole idea we're trying to do is trying to educate people. Like in this case, if you want to cry about the death penalty being bad, in this case, it's absolutely the best or one of the best arguments in the world because of the disparity in punishment Jack brought out. The bad guy walks, the hangalong gets killed.
The planner takes a stroll.
That's right. And he takes a stroll. And that's why, in fact, Scott Thoreau, who was the leader of the person up in Illinois, is that they changed the death penalty to life. Believing the death penalty started that commission. He said, when I got through, I didn't believe it anymore because we can't do it right. We never administer it fairly. This is a classic example where the least, as somebody once said, the least guilty gets executed. The most guilty is walking the streets. And well, that's a good argument.
Is this really a ritual? Are we just doing a ritual?
Well, the killing's ritualistic.
It's very.
Way we can keep our mind. It's like Somerset Maugham said, religion became ritualistic because you don't have to think about your sins. You can quote a bunch of BS and not think about how bad you are.
Somerset Maugham said that?
Yeah, he was talking about the importance of rituals. And this reason we have all these strange, stupid ritual things, last words, last meal, last this, last that.
It's all a ritual.
It takes our mind off the fact we're doing something unfair. And in this case, it's terribly unfair. And it's worth doing. It's worth all these lawyers' time.
And about how much time do you and the other attorneys put in preparation for the show?
Quite a bit, because what I do is, in this case is more difficult because it's so old, I couldn't find all the opinions. So I get on the internet and I dig up every appellate opinion I can find. And it takes me quite a while to put it all together, and then I put all the facts together based upon what the court opinions are, not what newspapers say, on what the court opinions say. And then I try to figure out what issues are pertinent. I assign each lawyer an issue to research, and they do independent research on their own. Once we talk about them, we meet prior to the station, the program, and then we go over all the stuff we're going to discuss.
I want to thank Jim Skelton, whose voice you just got through hearing, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee, who are our team of lawyers. We couldn't make the program happen if it weren't for Otis in here flipping switches. I want to thank Elizabeth Stein for being our producer. She does all the work. I just come in here and make myself available. Pat Hartwell on her own nickel and Dave Atwood, we're off-site reporters. Our music comes from a woman whose brother was recently scheduled for an execution. He dodged the bullet. So Victoria Panetti, and if you want to know more about Victoria Panetti, go to She Monster International, MySpace.com/SheMonster. My name is Ray Hill. My email address is hillray@sbcglobal.net. Thank you for listening to KPFT HD3 channel. We'll be back same place, same time, or I hope you got it on the internet. And tell your friends to listen up because everything we do remains on the website.